not the laser, you idiot. We'll inject the lethal dose of alcohol as planned. Here, hold the osmosis cuff so I can attach this drip. I felt a pressure on my right arm. A second later, there were explosions, concussions, a shout. I smelled smoke and ionized air. A woman screamed.
"Get that cuff off him," said Lee Hunt.
I could see him standing there, still wearing a conservative gray suit, surrounded by executive security commandos, in full impact armor and chameleon polymers. A commando twice Hunt's height nodded, shouldered his hell whip weapon, and rushed to do Hunt's bidding. On one of the tactical channels, the one I had been monitoring for some time, I could see a relayed image of myself, naked, spread-eagled on the bed, the osmosis cuff on my arm and a rising bruise on my ribcage. Diana Philomel, her husband, and one of the goons lay unconscious but alive in the splinter and broken glass rubble of the room. The other enforcer lay half in the doorway, the top part of his body looking the color and texture of a heavily grilled steak.
"Are you all right, M. Severn?"
asked Lee Hunt, lifting my head and setting a membrane-thin oxygen mask over my mouth and nose.
I said. "All right."
I swam to the surface of my own senses, like a diver coming up too quickly from the deeps. My head hurt. My ribs ached like hell. My eyes were not working perfectly yet, but through the tactical channel I could see Lee Hunt give the small twitch of thin lips that I knew passed for a smile from him.
"We'll help you get dressed," said Hunt. "Get you some coffee on the flight back. Then it's back to Government House, M. Severn. You're late for a meeting with the CEO."
7. Space battles in movies and hollies had always bored me, but watching the real thing held a certain fascination, rather like seeing live coverage of a series of traffic accidents. Actually, the production values for reality, as had doubtless been the case for centuries, were much lower than for even a moderate-budget holodrama. Even with the tremendous energies involved, the overwhelming reaction one had to an actual battle in space was that space was so large, and humanity's fleets and ships and dreadnoughts and whatnots were so small. Or so I thought, as I sat in the Tactical Information Center, the so-called War Room, with Gladstone in her military ganders, and watched the walls become 20-meter holes into infinity as four massive hollow frames surrounded us with in-depth imagery and the speakers filled the room with fatline transmissions. Radio chatter between fighters, tactical command channels rattling away, ship-to-ship messages on wideband, lasered channels and secure fatline, and all the shouts, screams, cries, and obscenities of battle which predate any media besides air and the human voice. It was a dramatization of total chaos, a functional definition of confusion, an unchoreographed dance of sad violence. It was war. Gladstone and a handful of her people sat in the middle of all this noise and light, the war room floating like a gray-carpeted rectangle amidst the stars and explosions, the limb of Hyperion, a lapis-lazuli brilliance filling half of the North Hollow Wall, the screams of dying men and women on every channel and in every ear. I was one of the handful of Gladstone's people privileged and cursed to be there. The CEO rotated in her high-backed chair, tapped her lower lip with steepled fingers, and turned toward her military group.
"What do you think?"
The 7 bemedaled men there looked at one another, and then 6 of them looked at General Morpurgo. He chewed on an unlighted cigar.
"It's not good," he said. "We're keeping them away from the Farcaster site. Our defenses are holding well there, but they've pushed far too far in system."
"Admiral?" asked Gladstone, inclining her head a fraction toward the tall, thin man in force space black. Admiral Singh touched his closely trimmed beard.
"General Morpurgo is correct. The campaign is not going as planned."
He nodded toward the fourth wall, where diagrams, mostly ellipsoids, ovals, and arcs, were superimposed upon a static shot of the Hyperion system. Some of the arcs grew as we watched. The bright blue lines stood for hegemony trajectories. The red tracks were ouster. There were far more red lines than blue.
"Both of the attack carriers assigned to Task Force 42 have been put out of action," said Admiral Singh. "The Olympus Shadow was destroyed with all hands, and the Neptune station was seriously damaged, but is returning to the cislunar docking area with 5 tort ships for escort."
CEO Gladstone nodded slowly, her lip coming down to touch the top of her steepled fingers. "How many were aboard the Olympus Shadow, Admiral?" Singh's brown eyes were as large as the CEO's, but did not suggest the same depths of sadness. He held her gaze for several seconds.
4,200, he said, not counting the marine detachment of 600. Some of those were offloaded at Farcaster Station Hyperion, so we do not have accurate information on how many were with the ship.
Gladstone nodded. She looked back at General Morpurgo. "Why the sudden difficulty, General?" Morpurgo's face was calm, but he had all but bitten through the cigar clamped between his teeth.
"More fighting units than we expected, CEO," he said. "Plus their lancers. 5-person craft, miniature tort ships, really faster and more heavily armed than our long-range fighters. They're deadly little hornets. We've been destroying them by the hundred, but if one gets through, it can make a dash inside fleet defenses and wreak havoc."
Morpurgo shrugged.
"More than one's got through."
Senator Kolchev sat across the table with 8 of his colleagues. Kolchev swiveled until he could see the tactical map.
"It looks like they're almost to Hyperion," he said.
The famous voice was hoarse.
Singh spoke up. "Remember the scale, Senator. The truth is that we still hold most of the system. Everything within 10 AU of Hyperion's star is ours. The battle was out beyond the Oort cloud, and we've been regrouping."
"And those red blobs above the plane of the ecliptic?" asked Senator Richaud. The senator wore red herself. It had been one of her trademarks in the Senate.
Singh nodded.
"An interesting stratagem," he said. "The swarm launched an attack of approximately 3,000 lancers to complete a pincers movement against Task Force 87.2's electronic perimeter. It was contained, but one has to admire the cleverness of..."
3,000 lancers," Gladstone interrupted softly.
"Yes, ma'am."
Gladstone smiled. I stopped sketching and thought to myself that I was glad that I had not been the beneficiary of that particular smile. "Weren't we told yesterday, in the briefing, that the ousters would field 600-700 fighting units tops?" The words had been more Purgos. CEO Gladstone swiveled to face the general. Her right eyebrow arched. General Morpurgo removed the cigar, frowned at it, and fished a smaller piece from behind his lower teeth.
"That's what our intelligence said. It was wrong."
Gladstone nodded. "Was the AI Advisory Council involved in that intelligence assessment?" All eyes turned toward Counselor Albedo. It was a perfect projection. He sat in his chair amongst the others, his hands curled on the armrest in a relaxed fashion. There was none of the haziness or see-through common to mobile projections. His face was long, with high cheekbones and a mobile mouth which suggested a hint of sardonic smile, even at the most serious of moments. This was a serious moment.
"No, CEO," said Counselor Albedo. "The advisory group was not asked to assess ouster strength."
Gladstone nodded. "I assumed," she said, still addressing Morpurgo, "that when the force intelligence estimates came in, they incorporated the Council's projections." The force ground general glared at Albedo.
"No, ma'am," he said. "Since the Corps acknowledges no contact with the ousters, we felt that their projections wouldn't be any better than our own. We did use the OCS-HTN aggregate AI network to run our assessments."
He thrust the foreshortened cigar back into his mouth. His chin jutted. When he spoke, it was around the cigar.
Could the council have done better?
Gladstone looked at Albedo. The councillor made a small motion with the long fingers of his right hand.
Our estimates for this swarm suggested 4,000 to 6,000 fighting units.
You,
began Moore Purgo, his face red.
You did not mention this during the briefing, said CEO Gladstone, nor during our earlier deliberations.
Councillor Albedo shrugged.
The general is correct, he said. We have no contact with the ousters. Our estimates are no more reliable than forces, merely based upon different premises. The Olympus Command School Historical Tactical Network does excellent work. If the AIs there were one order of acuity higher on the Turing-Demler scale, we would have to bring them into the core.
He made the graceful gesture with his hand again.
As it is, the Council's premises might be of use for future planning. We will, of course, turn over all projections to this group at any time.
Gladstone nodded. Do so immediately. She turned back to the screen, and the others did so also. Sensing the silence, the room monitors brought the speaker volume back up, and once again we could hear the cries of victory, screams for help, and calm recitation of positions, fire control directions, and commands. The closest wall was a real-time feed from the torch ship, HS N'Djamena, as it searched for survivors among the tumbling remnants of battlegroup B.5. The damaged torch ship it was approaching, magnified 1,000 times, looked like a pomegranate burst from the inside, its seeds and red rind spilling in slow motion, tumbling into a cloud of particles, gases, frozen volatiles, 1,000,000 microelectronics ripped from their cradles, food stores, tangled gear, and, recognizable now and then from their marionette tumble of arms or legs, many, many bodies. The N'Djamena's searchlight, 10 meters wide after its coherent leap of 20,000 miles, played across the starlit frozen wreckage, bringing individual items, facets, and faces into focus.
It was quite beautiful in a terrible way. The reflected light made Gladstone's face look much older.
Admiral, she said. Is it pertinent that the swarm waited until Task Force 87.2 translated in-system? Singh touched his beard.
Are you asking if it was a trap, CEO?
Yes. The Admiral glanced at his colleagues and then at Gladstone.
I think not. I believe that when the ousters saw the intensity of our force commitment, they responded in kind. It does mean, however, that they are totally resolved to take Hyperion system.
Can they do it? Asked Gladstone, her eyes still on the tumbling wreckage above her. A young man's body, half in a space suit and half out, tumbled toward the camera. The burst eyes and lungs were clearly visible.
No, said Admiral Singh. They can bloody us. They can even drive us back to a totally defensive perimeter around Hyperion itself. But they cannot defeat us or drive us out.
Or destroy the Farcaster?
Senator Richo's voice was taut.
Nor destroy the Farcaster, said Singh. He's right, said General Moore Purgo. I'd stake my professional career on it.
Gladstone smiled and stood. The others, including myself, rushed to stand also. You have, Gladstone said softly to Moore Purgo. You have. She looked around. We will meet here when events warrant it. M. Hunt will be my liaison with you. In the meantime, gentlemen and ladies, the work of government shall proceed. Good afternoon. As the others left, I took my seat again until I was the only one left in the room. The speakers came back up to volume. On one band a man was crying. Manic laughter came through static. Above me, behind me, on both sides, the starfields moved slowly against blackness, and the starlight glinted coldly on wreckage and ruin. Government House was constructed in the shape of a Star of David, and within the center of the star, shielded by low walls and strategically planted trees, there was a garden, smaller than the formal acres of flowers in Deer Park, but no less beautiful. I was walking there as evening fell, the brilliant blue-white of Tau Ceti fading to golds, when Mayna Gladstone approached. For a while we walked together in silence. I noticed that she had exchanged her suit for a long robe of the kind worn by grand matrons on Potoffa. The robe was wide and billowing, inset with intricate dark blue and gold designs, which almost matched the darkening sky. Gladstone's hands were out of sight in hidden pockets. The wide sleeves stirred to a breeze. The hem dragged on the milk-white stones of the path. "You let them interrogate me," I said. "I'm curious as to why." Gladstone's voice was tired. "They were not transmitting. There was no danger of the information being passed on." I smiled. "Nonetheless, you let them put me through that. Security wished to know as much about them as they would divulge. At the expense of any inconvenience on my part," I said. "Yes. And does security know who they were working for?" "The man mentioned Harbrit," said the CEO. "Security is fairly certain that they meant Emlem Harbrit." "The commodities broker on Asquith?" "Yes. She and Diana Philomel have ties with the old Glennon Height royalist factions." "They were amateurs," I said. Thinking of Hermund mentioning Harbrit's name, the confused order of Diana's questioning. "Of course. Are the royalists connected to any serious group?" "Only the Shrike Church," said Gladstone. She paused where the path crossed a small stream via a stone bridge. The CEO gathered her robe and sat on a wrought-iron bench. "None of the bishops have yet come out of hiding, you know." "With the riots and backlash, I don't blame them," I said. I remained standing. There were no bodyguards or monitors in sight, but I knew that if I were to make any threatening move toward Gladstone, I would wake up an exec-sec detention. Above us, the clouds lost their last tinge of gold and began to glow with the reflected silver light of T.C. Squared's countless tower cities. "What did security do with Diana and her husband?" I asked. "They've been thoroughly interrogated. They're being detained." I nodded. Thorough interrogation meant that even now their brains were floating in full-shunt tanks. Their bodies would be kept in cryogenic storage until a secret trial determined if their actions had been treasonable. After the trial, the bodies would be destroyed, and Diana and Hermund would remain in detention, with all sensory and calm channels turned off. The hegemony had not used the death penalty for centuries, but the alternatives were not pleasant. I sat on the long bench, 6 feet from Gladstone. "Do you still write poetry?" I was surprised by her question. I glanced down the garden path where floating Japanese lanterns and hidden glow globes had just come on. "Not really," I said. "Sometimes I dream in verse. Or used to." Mayna Gladstone folded her hands on her lap and studied them. "If you were writing about the events unfolding now," she said, "what kind of poem would you create?" I laughed. "I've already begun it and abandoned it twice. Or rather, he had. It was about the death of the gods and their difficulty in accepting their displacement. It was about transformation and suffering and injustice. And it was about the poet, whom he thought suffered most at such injustice." Gladstone looked at me. Her face was a mass of lines and shadows in the dimming light. "And who are the gods that are being replaced this time, M. Severn? Is it humanity? Or the false gods we created to depose us?" "How the hell should I know?" I snapped and turned away to watch the stream. "You're part of both worlds, no? Humanity and Technocore." I laughed again. "I'm part of neither world. A cybrid monster here, a research project there." "Yes, but whose research? And for what ends?" I shrugged. Gladstone rose, and I followed. We crossed the stream and listened to water moving over the stones. The path wound between tall boulders covered with exquisite lichen, which glowed in the lantern light. Gladstone paused at the top of a short flight of stone steps. "Do you think the ultimates in the Corps will succeed in constructing their ultimate intelligence, M. Severn? Will they build God?" I said. "There are those AIs which do not want to build God. They learned from the human experience that to construct the next step in awareness is an invitation to slavery, if not actual extinction. But would a true God extinguish his creatures?" "In the case of the Corps and the hypothetical UI," I said, "God is the creature, not the creator. Perhaps a God must create the lesser beings in contact with it, in order for it to feel any responsibility for them. Yet the Corps has appeared to take responsibility for human beings in the centuries since the AI secession," said Gladstone. She was gazing intently at me, as if gauging something by my expression. I looked out at the garden. The path glowed whitely, almost eerily in the dark. "The Corps works toward its own ends," I said, knowing as I spoke that no human being knew that fact better than CEO Mayna Gladstone. "And do you feel that humanity no longer figures as a means toward those ends?" I made a dismissive gesture with my right hand. "I'm a creature of neither culture," I said again, "neither graced by the naivete of the unintentional creators, nor cursed by the terrible awareness of their creatures." "Genetically, you are fully human," said Gladstone. It was not a question. I did not respond. "Jesus Christ was said to be fully human," she said, "and also fully divine. Humanity and Godhead at intersection." I was amazed at her reference to that old religion. Christianity had been replaced first by Zen Christianity, then Zen Gnosticism, then by 100 more vital theologies and philosophies. Gladstone's homeworld was no repository for discarded beliefs, and I assumed, and hoped, that neither was the CEO. "If he was fully human and fully God," I said, "then I am his antimatter image." "No," said Gladstone. "I would imagine that the shrike your pilgrim friends are confronting is that." I stared. It was the first time she had mentioned the shrike to me, despite the fact that I knew, and she knew that I knew, that it had been her plan which led the consul to open the time tombs and release the thing. "Perhaps you should have been on that pilgrimage, M. Severn," said the CEO. "In a way," I said, "I am." Gladstone gestured, and a door to her private quarters opened. "Yes, in a way you are," she said. "But if the woman who carries your counterpart is crucified on the shrike's legendary tree of thorns, will you suffer for all eternity in your dreams?" I had no answer, so I stood there and said nothing. "We will talk in the morning after the conference," said Mayna Gladstone. "Good night, M. Severn. Have pleasant dreams." 8. Martin Silenus, Saul Weintraub, and the consul are staggering up the dunes toward the Sphinx, as Braun Lamia and Fedmon Kassad return with Father Hoyt's body. Weintraub clutches his cape tight around him, trying to shelter his infant from the rage of blowing sand and crackling light. He watches as Kassad descends the dune, his long legs black and cartoonish against electrified sand, Hoyt's arms and hands dangling, moving slightly with each slide and step. Silenus is shouting, but the wind whips away words. Braun Lamia gestures toward the one tent still standing. The storm has collapsed or ripped away the others. They crowd into Silenus's tent, Colonel Kassad coming last, passing the body in gently. Inside, their shouts can be heard above the crack of fiber-plastic canvas and the paper-splitting rip of lightning. "Dead?" shouts the consul, peeling back the cloak Kassad had wrapped around Hoyt's nude body. The cruciforms glow pinkly. The colonel points to the telltales blinking on the surface of the force-issue med pack adhered to the priest's chest. The lights blink red except for the yellow winking of the system-sustaining filaments and nodules. Hoyt's head rolls back, and now Weintraub can see the millipede suture holding the ragged edges of the slashed throat together. Saul Weintraub tries to locate a pulse manually, finds none. He leans forward, sets his ear to the priest's chest. There is no heartbeat, but the welt of the cruciform there is hot against Saul's cheek. He looks at Braun Lamia.
The Shrike?
Yes, I think, I don't know. She gestures toward the antique pistol she still holds. I emptied the magazine, 12 shots it, whatever it was.
Did you see it? The consul asks Kassad.
No. I entered the room 10 seconds after Braun, but I didn't see anything.
What about your fucking soldier gadgets? Says Martin Silenus. He is crowded in the back of the tent, huddled in a near-fetal position. Didn't all that force shit show something?
No.
A small alarm sounds from the med pack, and Kassad detaches another plasma cartridge from his belt, feeds it into the pack's chamber, and sits back on his heels, flipping his visor down to watch out the opening of the tent. His voice is distorted by the helmet speaker.
He's lost more blood than we can compensate for here. Did anyone else bring first aid equipment?
Weintraub rummages in his pack.
I have a basic kit. Not enough for this, though. Whatever slashed his throat cut through everything.
The Shrike, whispers Martin Silenus.
It doesn't matter, says Lamia, hugging herself to stop her body from shaking. We've got to get help for him. She looks at the consul.
He's dead, says the consul. Even a ship's surgery won't bring him back.
We have to try, shouts Lamia, leaning forward to grab the consul's tunic front. We can't leave him to those things. She gestures toward the cruciform glowing beneath the skin of the dead man's chest. The consul rubs his eyes.
We can destroy the body. Use the colonel's rifle.
We're going to die if we don't get out of this fucking storm, cries Silenus.
The tent is vibrating, fiber plastic pounding the poet's head and back with each billow. The sound of sand against fabric is like a rocket taking off just outside.
Call the goddamn ship, call it!
The consul pulls his pack closer, as if guarding the antique comm log inside it. Sweat glistens on his cheeks and forehead.
We could wait the storm out in one of the tombs, says Saul Weintraub. The Sphinx, perhaps?
Fuck that, says Martin Silenus.
The scholar shifts in the cramped space and stares at the poet. You came all this way to find the Shrike. Are you telling us that you've changed your mind now that he seems to have made an appearance? Silenus's eyes gleam out from under his lowered beret.
I'm not telling you anything, except that I want that goddamn ship of his here, and I want it now.
It might be a good idea, says Colonel Kassad.
The consul looks at him.
If there's a chance to save Hoyt's life, we should take it.
The consul is in pain himself. We can't leave, he says.
Can't leave now. No, agrees Kassad. We won't use the ship to leave. But the surgery might help Hoyt, and we can wait out the storm in it.
And maybe find out what's happening up there, says Braun Lamia, jerking her thumb toward the roof of the tent. The baby Rachel is crying shrilly. Weintraub rocks her, holding her head in his broad hand.
I agree, he says. If the Shrike wants to find us, it can find us on the ship as easily as out here. We'll make sure that no one leaves.
He touches Hoyt's chest.
As horrible as it sounds, the information the surgery gives us on how this parasite works could be priceless to the web.
All right, says the consul.
He pulls the ancient comm log from his pack, lays his hand on the disc key, and whispers several phrases.
Is it coming?
Asks Martin Silenus.
It's confirmed the command. We'll need to stow our gear for transfer. I told it to land just above the entrance to the valley.
Lamia is surprised to find that she has been weeping. She wipes her cheeks and smiles.
What's funny?
Asks the consul.
All this, she says,
stabbing at her cheeks with the back of her hand. And all I can think about is how nice it'd be to have a shower.
A drink, says Silenus.
Shelter from the storm, says Weintraub. The baby is taking milk from a nursing pack. Kassad leans forward, his head and shoulders outside the tent. He raises his weapon and clicks off the safety. Telltales, he says. Something's moving just beyond the dune. The visor turns toward them, reflecting a pale and huddled group, the paler body of Lennar Hoyt. I'm going to check it out, he says. Wait here until the ship arrives.
Don't leave, says Silenus. It's like one of those fucking ancient horror hollows where they go one by one to... Hey!
The poet falls silent. The entrance to the tent is a triangle of light and noise. Fedmon Kassad is gone. The tent is beginning to collapse. Stakes and wire anchors giving way as the sands shift around them. Huddled together, shouting to be heard over the wind roar, the consul and Lamia wrap Hoyt's body in his cloak. Readouts on the med pack continue to blink red. Blood has ceased to flow from the crude millipede suture. Saul Weintraub sets his four-day-old child in the infant carrier on his chest, folds his cape around her, and crouches in the entrance. No sign of the colonel, he shouts. As he watches, a lightning bolt strikes the outstretched wing of the Sphinx. Braun Lamia moves to the entrance and lifts the priest's body. She is amazed at how light it is. Let's get Father Hoyt to the ship and in surgery. Then some of us will come back to search for Kassad. The consul tugs his tricorn cap low and shrugs his collar high. The ship has deep radar and movement sensors. It'll tell us where the colonel's gone. And the shrike, says Silenus. Can't forget our host. Let's go, says Lamia and gets to her feet. She has to lean into the wind to make progress. Loose ends of Hoyt's cloak flap and crack around her, while her own cloak streams behind. Finding the path by the intermittent flashes of lightning, she moves toward the head of the valley, glancing back only once to see if the others are following. Martin Silenus steps away from the tent, lifts Hetmastine's Mobius cube, and his purple beret whips away in the wind, climbing as it goes. Silenus stands there and curses impressively, stopping only when his mouth begins to fill with sand.
Come,
shouts Weintraub, his hand on the poet's shoulder. Saul feels the sand striking his face, littering his short beard. His other hand covers his chest as if sheltering something infinitely precious.
We'll lose sight of Braun if we don't hurry.
The two help each other move forward against the wind. Silenus's fur coat ripples wildly as he detours to retrieve his beret from where it has come down in the lee of a dune. The consul is the last to leave, carrying both his own pack and Kassad's. A minute after he leaves the small shelter, stakes give way, fabric tears, and the tent flies into the night, surrounded by a halo of static electricity. He staggers the 300 meters up the trail, occasionally catching glimpses of the two men ahead of him, more frequently losing the path and having to walk in circles until he comes across it again. The time tombs are visible behind him when the sandstorm ebbs a bit and the lightning flashes follow one another in close succession. The consul sees the Sphinx, still glowing from repeated electrical strikes, the jade tomb beyond it, its walls luminescent, and beyond them the obelisk. No glow there, a vertical swipe of pure black against the cliff walls. Then the crystal monolith. There is no sign of Kassad, although the shifting dunes, blowing sand, and sudden flashes make it seem as if many things are moving. The consul looks up, seeing the wide entrance to the valley now and the rushing clouds low above it, half expecting to see the blue fusion glow of his ship lowering through them. The storm is terrible, but his spacecraft has landed in worse conditions. He wonders if it is already down and the others are waiting at the base of it for him to arrive. But when he reaches the saddle between cliff walls at the opening of the valley, the wind assaults him anew. He sees the four others huddled together at the beginning of the broad, flat plain, but there is no ship.
"Shouldn't it be here by now?" shouts Lamia as the consul approaches the group.
He nods and crouches to extract the comm log from his pack. Weintraub and Silenus stand behind him, bending over to offer some shelter from the blowing sand. The consul extracts the comm log and pauses, looking around. The storm makes it appear as if they are in some mad room where the walls and ceiling change from instant to instant, one second closing in on them, scant meters away, the next second receding to the distance, the ceiling floating upward, as if in the scene where the room and Christmas tree expand for Clara in Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker. The consul palms the disc key, bends forward, and whispers into the voice square. The ancient instrument whispers back to him, the words just audible above the rasp of sand. He straightens up and faces the others. The ship was not allowed to leave. There is a babble of protest. "What do you mean, not allowed?" asks Lamia when the others fall silent. The consul shrugs and looks skyward, as if a blue tail of flame might still announce the ship's coming. "It wasn't given clearance at the spaceport in Keats."
"Didn't you say you had clearance from the fucking queen?"
shouts Martin Silenus.
"Old Gallstone herself?"
"Gladstone's clearance pip was in the ship's memory," says the consul. "Both the force and port authorities knew that."
"So what the hell happened?"
Lamia wipes her face. The tears she had shed back at the tent have left tiny rivulets of mud in the coating of sand on her cheeks. The consul shrugs. "Gladstone overrode the original pip. There's a message here from her. Do you want to hear it?" For a minute, no one answers. After their week of voyage, the thought of being in touch with someone outside their own group is so incongruous that it does not register at once. It was as if the world beyond the pilgrimage had ceased to exist except for the explosions in the night sky.
"Yes," Saul Weintraub says. "Let's hear it."
A sudden lull in the storm makes the words seem very loud. They gather around and crouch near the old comm log, setting Father Hoyt in the center of their circle. In the minute they have left him unattended, a small dune has begun to form itself around his body. The telltales are all red now, except for the extreme measures monitor's glowing amber. Lamia sets another plasma cartridge in place and makes sure that the osmosis mask is secure on Hoyt's mouth and nose, filtering pure oxygen in and keeping sand out. "All right," she says. The consul triggers the disc key. The message is a fat line squirt, recorded by the ship some 10 minutes earlier. The air mists with the data columns and spherical image colloid, which characterizes comm logs dating back to the Hegira. The image of Gladstone shimmers, her face distorting bizarrely and then almost comically, as millions of specks of wind-blown sand rip through the image. Even at full volume, her voice is almost lost to the storm.
"I'm sorry," says the familiar image, "but I cannot allow your spacecraft to approach the tombs just yet. The temptation to leave would be too great, and the importance of your mission must override all other factors. Please understand that the fate of worlds may rest with you. Please be assured that my hopes and prayers are with you. Gladstone out."
The image folds into itself and fades away. The consul, Weintraub, and Lamia continue to stare in silence. Martin Silenus stands, throws a handful of sand at the empty air where Gladstone's face had been seconds earlier, and screams,
"Goddamn father-fucking-asshole politician, moral paraplegic dipshit drag queen bitch!"
He kicks sand in the air. The others shift their stares to him.
"Well, that really helped," Braun Lamia says softly.
Silenus waves his arms in disgust and walks away, still kicking at dunes.
"Is there anything else?" Weintraub asks the consul.
"No."
Braun Lamia crosses her arms and frowns at the comm log.
"I forget how you said this thing works. How are you getting through the interference?"
"Tight beam to a pocket commsat I seated as we came down from the Yggdrasil," says the consul. Lamia nods.
"So when you reported in, you just sent brief messages to the ship, and it sent fat line squirts to Gladstone, and your ouster contacts?"
"Yes."
"Can the ship take off without clearance?" asks Weintraub.
The older man is sitting, his knees raised and his arms draped on them in a classic posture of pure fatigue. His voice is also tired. Just override Gladstone's prohibition?
No, says the consul.
When Gladstone said no, Force set a Class 3 containment field over the blast pit where we parked the ship.
Get in touch with her, says Braun Lamia. Explain things.
I've tried. The consul holds the comm log in his hands, sets it back in the pack. No response. Also, I mentioned in the original squirt that Hoyt was badly hurt and that we needed medical help. I wanted the ship's surgery ready for him.
Hurt, repeats Martin Silenus, striding back to where they huddled. Shit, our padre friend is dead as Glennon Heights' dog.
He jerks his thumb in the direction of the cloak-wrapped body. All monitor displays are red. Braun Lamia bends closer and touches Hoyt's cheek. It is cold. Both his comlog biomonitor and the med pack begin chirping brain death warnings. The osmosis mask continues to force pure O2 into his lungs, and the med pack stimulators still work his lungs and heart, but the chirping rises to a scream and then settles to a steady, terrible tone.
He lost too much blood, says Saul Weintraub.
He touches the dead priest's face, his own eyes closed, head bowed.
Great, says Silenus. Fucking great. And according to his own story, Hort's going to decompose and recompose, thanks to that goddamned cruciform thing. Two of the goddamn things. The guy's rich in resurrection insurance. And then come lurching back like some brain-damaged edition of Hamlet's daddy's ghost. What are we going to do then?
Shut up, says Braun Lamia. She is wrapping Hoyt's body in a layer of tarp she has brought from the tent.
Shut up yourself, screams Silenus. We've got one monster lurking around. Old Grendel himself is out there somewhere, sharpening his nails for his next meal. Do you really want Hoyt's zombie joining our happy crew? You remember how he described the Bakura? They'd been letting the cruciforms bring them back for centuries, and talking to one of them was like talking to an ambulatory sponge. Do you really want Hoyt's corpse hiking with us?
Two, says the consul.
What?
Martin Silenus whirls, loses his footing, and lands on his knees near the body. He leans toward the old scholar.
What did you say?
Two cruciforms, says the consul. His and Father Paul Duret's. If his story about the Bakura was true, then they'll both be resurrected.
Oh, Christ on a stick,
says Silenus and sits in the sand. Braun Lamia has finished wrapping the priest's body. She looks at it. I remember that in Father Duret's story about the Bakura named Alpha, she says. But I still don't understand. The law of conservation of mass has to come in there somewhere.
They'll be short zombies, says Martin Silenus.
He pulls his fur coat tighter and pounds the sand with his fist. There is so much we could have learned if the ship had arrived, says the consul. The auto-diagnostics could have... He pauses and gestures.
Look. There is less sand in the air. Perhaps the storm is...
Lightning flashes, and it begins to rain, the icy pellets striking their faces with more fury than the sandstorm had shown. Martin Silenus begins to laugh.
It's a fucking desert! He shouts toward the sky. We'll probably drown in a flood!
We need to get out of this, says Saul Weintraub. His baby's face is visible between the gaps in his cloak.
Rachel is crying. Her face is very red. She looks no older than a newborn.
Keep Kronos, says Lamia. It's a couple of hours.
Too far, says the consul. Let's bivouac in one of the tombs.
Silenus laughs again. He says, who are these coming to the sacrifice? To what green altar, O mysterious priest? Leads thou that heifer lowing at the skies, and all her silken flanks with garlands dressed?
Does that mean yes? Asks Lamia.
That means fucking why not? Laughs Silenus. Why make it hard for our cold muse to find us? We can watch our friend decompose while we wait. How long did Duret's tale say it took for one of the Bakura to rejoin the flock after death interrupted their grazing?
3 days, says the consul.
Martin Silenus slaps his forehead with the heel of his palm.
Of course, how could I forget? How wonderfully fitting, New Testament-wise.
In the meantime, maybe our Shrike Wolf will carry off a few of this flock. Do you think the Padre would mind if I borrowed one of his cruciforms just in case? I mean, he has a spare.
Let's go, says the consul. Rain drips from his tricorn cap in a steady stream. We'll stay in the Sphinx until morning. I'll carry Kassad's extra gear and the Mobius cube. Braun, you carry Hoyt's things and Saul's pack. Saul, you keep the baby warm and dry.
What about the Padre?
Asks the poet, jerking his thumb in the direction of the body.
You're carrying Father Hoyt, Braun Lamia says softly, turning.
Martin Silenus opens his mouth, sees the pistol in Lamia's hand, shrugs and bends to lift the body to his shoulder.
Who's going to carry Kassad when we find him? He asks. Of course, he could be in enough pieces that we could all—
Please shut up, Braun Lamia says tiredly. If I have to shoot you, it will give us one more thing to carry. Just walk.
With the consul leading, Weintraub coming closely behind, Martin Silenus staggering along some meters back, and Braun Lamia in the rear, the group once again descends the low call into the Valley of the Tombs. 9.
CEO Gladstone's schedule that morning was a busy one. Tau Ceti Center has a 23-hour day, which makes it convenient for the government to run on hegemony standard time without totally destroying local diurnal rhythms. At 0545 hours, Gladstone met with her military advisors. At 0630 hours, she breakfasted with 24 of the most important senators and with representatives of the All-Thing and the Techno-Corps. At 0715, the CEO forecast to Renaissance Vector, where it was evening, to officially open the Hermes Medical Center in Cadua. At 0740, she cast back to Government House for a meeting with her top aides, including Lee Hunt, to go over the speech she was to give to the Senate and All-Thing at 1000 hours. At 0830, Gladstone met again with General Morpurgo and Admiral Singh for an update on the situation in the Hyperion system. At 0845 hours, she met with me.
Good morning, M. Severn, said the CEO. She was behind her desk in the office where I'd first met her 3 nights earlier. She waved her hand toward a buffet against the wall where hot coffee, tea, and kafta sat in sterling silver pots. I shook my head and sat down. 3 of the holographic windows showed white light, but the one to my left offered the 3D map of Hyperion system that I had tried to decode in the war room. It seemed to me that Ouster Red now covered and infiltrated the system, like dye dissolving and settling into a blue solution.
I want to hear your dreams, said CEO Gladstone. I want to hear why you abandoned them, I said, voice flat. Why you left Father Hoyt to die.
Gladstone could not have been used to being spoken to in that tone, not after 48 years in the Senate and a decade and a half as CEO. But her only reaction was to raise one eyebrow a fraction of an inch.
So you do dream the real events. Did you doubt it?
She set down the work pad she had been holding, keyed it off, and shook her head.
Not really, but it is still a shock to hear about something that no one else in the web knows about.
Why did you deny them the use of the consul's ship? Gladstone swiveled to look up at the window where the tactical display shifted and changed as new updates changed the flow of red, the retreat of blue, the movement of planets and moons. But if the military situation was to have been part of her explanation, she abandoned that approach. She swiveled back.
Why would I have to explain any executive decision to you, M. Severn? What is your constituency? Whom do you represent?
I represent those 5 people and a baby you left stranded on Hyperion, I said. Hoyt could have been saved. Gladstone made a fist and tapped her lower lip with a curved forefinger.
Perhaps, she said.
And perhaps he was already dead. But that wasn't the issue, was it? I sat back in the chair. I had not bothered to bring a sketchbook along, and my fingers ached to hold something. What is, then?
Do you remember Father Hoyt's story?
The story he told during their voyage to the tombs? Asked Gladstone.
Yes.
Each of the pilgrims is allowed to petition the shrike for one favor. Tradition says that the creature grants one wish while denying the others and murdering those he denies. Do you remember what Hoyt's wish was? I paused. Recalling incidents from the pilgrim's past was like trying to remember details of last week's dreams. He wanted the cruciforms removed, I said. He wanted freedom for both Father DeRay's soul, DNA, whatever, and for himself.
Not quite, said Gladstone.
Father Hoyt wanted to die. I stood up, almost knocking my chair over, and strode to the pulsing map. That's pure bullshit, I said. Even if he did, the others had an obligation to save him, and so did you. You let him die.
Yes. Just as you're going to let the rest of them die?
Not necessarily, said CEO Mayna Gladstone. That is their will, and the Shrike's, if such a creature actually exists. All I know at this point is that their pilgrimage is too important to allow them a means of retreat at the moment of decision.
Whose decision? Theirs? How can the lives of 6 or 7 people and a baby affect the outcome of a society of 150 billion?
I knew the answer to that, of course. The AI Advisory Council, as well as the hegemony's less sentient predictors, had chosen the pilgrims very carefully.
But for what?
Unpredictability. They were ciphers that matched the ultimate enigma of the entire Hyperion equation. Did Gladstone know that? Or did she know only what Counselor Albedo and her own spies told her? I sighed and returned to my chair.
Did your dream tell you what the fate of Colonel Cassad was? Asked the CEO.
No. I awoke before they returned to the Sphinx to seek shelter from the storm. Gladstone smiled slightly.
You realize, M. Severn, that for our purposes it would be more convenient to have you sedated, prompted by the same truth talk your Philomel friends used, and connected to sub-vocalizers, for a more constant report on the events on Hyperion.
I returned her smile.
Yes, I said, that would be more convenient, but it would be less than convenient for you if I slipped away into the core via the datasphere and left my body behind, which is precisely what I will do if put under duress again.
Of course, said Gladstone. That is precisely what I would do if put in such circumstances. Tell me, M. Severn, what is it like in the core? What is it like in that distant place where your consciousness truly resides?
Busy, I said.
Did you want to see me for anything else today?
Gladstone smiled again, and I sensed that it was a true smile. Not the politician's weapon she used so well.
Yes, she said. I did have something else in mind.
Would you like to go to Hyperion?
The real Hyperion?
The real Hyperion? I echoed stupidly. I felt my fingers and toes tingle, as a strange sense of excitement suffused me. My consciousness might truly reside in the core, but my body and brain were all too human, all too susceptible to adrenaline and other random chemicals. Gladstone nodded.
Millions of people want to go there. Farcast to somewhere new. Watch the war from up close. She sighed and moved her work pad.
The idiots.
She looked up at me, and her brown eyes were serious. But I want someone to go there and report back to me in person. Leah's using one of the new military Farcast terminals this morning, and I thought that you might join him. There might not be time to set down on Hyperion itself, but you would be in system. I thought of several questions, and was embarrassed by the first one that emerged.
Will it be dangerous?
Neither Gladstone's expression nor tone changed. Possibly. Although you will be far behind the lines, and Lee has explicit instructions not to expose himself or you to any obvious risk.
Obvious risk, I thought. But how many less than obvious risks were there in a war zone, near a world where a creature like the Shrike roamed free?
Yes, I said. I'll go. But there's one thing.
Yes.
I need to know why you want me to go.
It seems that if you just want me for my connection to the pilgrims, you're running a needless risk in sending me away.
Gladstone nodded.
M. Severn, it's true that your connection to the pilgrims, although somewhat tenuous, is of interest to me. But it is also true that I am interested in your observations and evaluations. Your observations.
But I'm nothing to you, I said.
You don't know who else I might be reporting to, deliberately or otherwise. I'm a creature of the Technocorps.
Yes, said Gladstone.
But you also may be the least affiliated person on Tau Ceti Center at this moment, perhaps in the entire web. Also, your observations are those of a trained poet, a man whose genius I respect.
I barked a laugh.
He was a genius, I said. I'm a simulacrum, a drone, a caricature.
Are you so sure? Asked Mayna Gladstone.
I held up empty hands. I haven't written a line of poetry in the 10 months I have been alive and aware in this strange afterlife, I said. I do not think in poetry. Isn't that proof enough that this core retrieval project is a sham? Even my false name is an insult to a man infinitely more talented than I will ever be. Joseph Severn was a shade in comparison to the real Keats, but I sully his name by using it.
That may be true, said Gladstone. And it may not. In either case, I've requested that you go with M. Hunt on this brief trip to Hyperion. She paused.
You have no duty to go.
In more than one sense, you are not even a citizen of the hegemony. But I would appreciate it if you did go.
I'll go, I said again, hearing my own voice as if from a distance.
Very good. You'll need warm clothes. Wear nothing that would come loose or cause embarrassment in free fall, although there is little likelihood that you will encounter that. Meet M. Hunt in the primary government house Farcaster Nexus in... She glanced at her comm log. 12 minutes.
I nodded and turned to go.
Oh, M. Severn.
I paused by the door.
The old woman behind the desk suddenly looked rather small and very tired.
Thank you, M. Severn, she said.
It was true that millions wanted to forecast to the war zone. The all thing was shrill with petitions, arguments for letting citizens cast to Hyperion, requests by cruise lines to run brief excursions, and demands by planetary politicians and hegemony representatives to be allowed to tour the system on fact-finding missions. All such requests had been denied. Web citizens, especially web citizens with power and influence, were not used to being denied access to new experiences, and for the hegemony, all-out war remained one of the few experiences still untried. But the CEO's office and the force authorities remained adamant. No civilian or unauthorized forecasting to the Hyperion system. No uncensored news steep coverage. In an age where no information was inaccessible, no travel denied, such exclusion was maddening and tantalizing. I met M. Hunt at the executive Farcaster Nexus after showing my authorization pip to an even dozen security nodes. Hunt was wearing black wool, undecorated, but evocative of the force uniforms present everywhere in this section of government house. I had had little time to change, returning to my apartments only to grab a loose vest with many pockets to hold drawing materials and a 35mm imager.
Ready? Said Hunt.
The Basset Hound face did not look pleased to see me. He carried a plain black valise. I nodded. Hunt gestured toward a force transport technician, and a one-time portal shimmered into existence. I knew that the thing was tuned to our DNA signatures and would admit no one else. Hunt took a breath and stepped through. I watched the quicksilver portal surface ripple after his passage, like a stream returning to calm after the slightest of breezes. And then I stepped through myself. It was rumored that the original Farcaster prototypes had offered no sensation during transition, and that the AI and human designers had altered the machinery to add that vague, prickling, ozone-charged feeling, to give the traveler a sense of having traveled. Whatever the truth of that,
my skin was still alive with tension as I took a step away from the portal, paused, and looked around. It's strange but true that war-going spacecraft have been depicted in fiction, film, Hollow, and StimSim for more than 800 years, even before humankind had left old